This episode courtesy of Gretsch Drums and that great Gretsch sound. Visit GretschDrums.com to see the latest gear and sign up for the Gretsch newsletter.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are fucking all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about in this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in once in a while?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas, with Sue Foley. Sue, thank you for coming over today.
Thank you for having me.
Sue's got a new record out, newish.
Yep.
Pinky's Blues.
Yep.
Check it out. We're going to get to that. We're going to come back. We'll come back around. Just get that plug in up front.
Yeah. Right.
I want to get into, you're from Canada. You're from Ottawa.
I am.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I want to get into how you got to Austin, Texas, how that all happened for you.
Yeah, it's a good, I mean, it's kind of an interesting series of events because it's hard to imagine a young girl from Canada would be invited down to Austin at the height of, you know, the blues explosion down here. But anyway, I was playing guitar already, been playing guitar since I was 13, and when I discovered blues music at 15, I kind of found an avenue to focus on, like a something really specific to focus on. I fell in love with blues, and right about that time was when the Vaughn Brothers really broke out, both the Fabulous Thunderbirds and Stevie Ray. Of course, Stevie Ray really broke out, and all the guitar players that I knew were, wow, everybody was freaking out, right? Like, Stevie Ray was just blowing up, and it was like the blues was just blowing up at the same time, the whole scene. It was really an exciting time.
Would you say he was the first Vaughn that caught your attention?
Oh, well, definitely, because he was the first one I became aware of, and then somehow I became aware of the Fabulous Thunderbirds very soon after. And I saw Stevie when I was about 16 in Ottawa, and then I saw the T-Birds around the same time. I was 16 or 17, and I was really jazzed about what was going on in Texas. Everybody was, but I was super stoked. And when I saw Jimmy, like, I love Stevie, but when I saw Jimmy, I freaked out. There was just something about his whole sensibility, his aesthetic, everything. Yeah. I just was mesmerized by him. So I fell in love with Austin, and then, you know, we started probably, I got to Vancouver when I was about 18. I left Ottawa, graduated from high school, left home, went to Vancouver.
Why Vancouver?
Because I'm from Ottawa, sort of a mid-sized city. The two, you know, the other options in Canada to go to a bigger city to spread my wings was Toronto, Montreal, or Vancouver. It's pretty much all you got there.
Yeah. But was there any reason that Vancouver won?
Yeah, it was farthest away. I wanted to go as far away as I could.
So what does that look like? Do you know anyone in Vancouver at this point?
I kind of knew one person loosely, but not really. I would say I showed up to Vancouver completely alone.
So yeah, I love this stuff. So you have a car?
No, I didn't drive. No.
Oh, you're 16?
I was 18 when I left home.
What's the driving age there, by the way?
16.
Oh, it is.
But I never drove. I mean, I just...
Okay.
I lived in the city, and I was a teenager. I never needed to drive. Didn't even consider driving, really. It didn't really interest me.
So what did you do? Train? Bus? What are we talking here?
Buses and walking.
This is
everywhere.
So old school. I love it.
It is so old school. I mean, I used to walk with my guitar. I think about it now. I used to, like, It was about 3 miles to the downtown area where we used to, there was a blues jam. I used to walk with my guitar the whole way, just carry it. And it was a big guitar. It was like a big old box arch top thing that I had.
So right, right.
Didn't even think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're so, I don't know, I was so in love with the music and just everything.
So you showed, well, I mean, seriously, suitcase guitar? Like
suitcase guitar. I moved to Vancouver.
Show up. Just.
I just showed up.
You have a place to crash? I mean, with the friend or?
No, I think I just, I don't even remember what I did. I didn't stay with a friend. But I got a place right away. So I guess I got a part-time rental and then I got a place pretty much right away, right downtown. I got an apartment. And I was even too young to go into bars at that time. The age was 19, so I kind of had to be coy about it.
Fake ID?
I didn't have fake ID, but I was just, I was close to my 19th birthday, so I was just getting there. I was just faking it.
So we just lied.
Hoping they didn't, yeah, hoping they didn't bust me.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went to the blues jam, and there was a blues jam at a place called The Yale in Vancouver. It was a pretty well-known bar, and just a big old sort of tavern, and they had a blues jam every Saturday and Sunday afternoons, and I just started going down there and hanging out. And that's where I met, you know, all the players, all the local players. And I figured I'd show up and get a gig as a guitar player, but all the gigs were sewn up, so I had to start my own band, basically. And that's how Sue Foley started. I never really had intended to do that. I didn't even know what that would look like. It's just that I couldn't get a gig, so I had to make a gig.
Right.
I found some players my age. We started jamming. I faked everything. Everything was fake until you make it.
Yeah.
Still is, really.
Yeah.
So.
No, it's the best way. You just jump in and you just go.
Just go. And
it's good to be young. You don't know any better. No fear.
There's no fear. I was fearless. I can honestly say I was fearless.
Yeah. No, that's the best part.
I didn't know that anything bad could even happen to me. I was just like, I think now, oh my God, you know, if I had an 18-year-old daughter, would I let her do that? Probably not.
Probably not. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you get a band going in Vancouver.
Yeah.
You're playing out. It just starts happening
slowly.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to book myself. And these are all the things you learn as a front person. You know, you kind of have to do everything. And you still do. I still do to this day. And I don't book myself anymore, but there's a million hats we wear. But I learned fast that I had to book myself. I had to get a demo tape. I mean, all these things, I didn't have anything in place. I had to make a bio. I mean, we were just making it up as we went along, and obviously no computers or nothing like that at all. Everything was done with pen and paper.
You gotta go into the venue. You have to go there.
You have to go there, and then you'd have to get a gig, and you'd have to make your own poster, and then put the posters up around town, you know, do all those jobs. But I did it all. I was very determined, and I booked myself right across the country. I mean, I was pretty pretty driven, and I was amazed when somebody hired me for the first time. I was like, really? Okay, let's do it. And then I didn't even have enough material to do a show, so I'd have to just make up songs on the spot, or I did a lot of that, like you just plug in a blues song and start jamming and then making up words to kind of fill in time, because we had to play at least 3 hours a night, 3 hour sets. It was always three sets a night. And that's how I learned. And I booked myself across Canada. Then we came to the attention of a guy out of Berkeley named Mark Hummel. He was touring up in Canada. He was a pretty well-known harmonica player, and he saw my band, and he hired my whole band to come to the States with him.
Nice.
So that's how we got stateside. Now, all this time, I was thinking about Austin. I'd seen the Thunderbirds. I'd seen Stevie. I saw an Antones Roadshow that came through Vancouver that featured Angela Straley and George Raines and the house band people, I think Derek O'Brien and Denny, and then all the guests like James Cotton. I think Buddy Guy was on it. It was just like a heavy-hitting show. I was just like, I saw that show. I was like, I have to go to Austin. I don't know how. I was almost ready to just pack and leave, but I didn't know how to get there or what to do when I got there. I didn't know anybody, obviously. But I just had this such a strong desire for it. I even think about it now and think, wow, it's so, almost like that desire made it all happen, you know. But a few months later, we were playing in Ontario, and Angela Straley, who I'd seen on the road show, was on that festival with us in Ontario, and she saw us. She told Clifford Antone about me, apparently, and she was running the Antones record label at the time, so they were probably scouting for young artists or young blues artists. And then we were on the road. We got stateside with Mark Hummel. We were touring with him, and we toured nonstop. It was nonstop, a whole year of nonstop touring.
And where are you touring? All around the States?
All over the States.
In a van?
A lot up in I-5, you know, up and down I-5. We did that a lot, up the West Coast, and then across the South a couple of times, into the Midwest, into Colorado, but we were moving the whole time.
And this is, you have a three-piece band?
I had a four-piece band, two guitars, bass, and drums.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so we all played the, you know, traditional Chicago blues with Mark, which was great, because you should know how to play all that stuff. It's really important stuff to play and know how to play. So I had a good education doing all that. Clifford Antone saw us in Memphis and saw me, and he had already heard about me, and he's just said, hey, send me a demo tape, send me something.
So he approaches you after the show?
Yeah, he saw me at that in Memphis, and he came up and said, hey, I'm Cliff. And I was like, I know. I knew who he was. We knew everything about Austin. So when I met him, it was just like, send me something. I got off the road from touring, and I sent him a little demo tape, and he called me. When he got it, there was a song on it I did called Gone Blind, which was a solo piece. Most of the tape was just me and my band, but then there was one tune that was solo, and it was kind of a low-down thing, an E, something like you'd hear Lightnin' Hopkins do or something. And he was just astounded that there was a little girl in Canada playing like Lightnin' Hopkins. So he could not believe it, and he was like, that song, he goes, did you write that? I was like, yeah, I wrote that. He goes, well, what are you doing? I said, nothing, I just got off the road. He goes, well, you want to come to Austin? I was like, yeah. He goes, I said, when? He goes, tomorrow. I was like, okay. And that was it.
How old are you at this point?
I was 21.
Okay.
So I'd been sort of honing my skills, and I started gigging at 16 in Ottawa. By the time I left Ottawa, I'd been playing a lot. I played a lot, and a lot of straight sort of traditional Chicago style blues. I was in a blues band. I played country blues. I'd been studying blues, and then when I moved to Vancouver, I did my own thing, but then we played with Mark Hummel, so there was more of that. So I'd been on the road for 3 years almost, you know, doing it.
And it was always strictly blues?
Always, yeah. Yeah, I don't do anything else.
Yeah. Did you ever get asked, by the way? At that point, were you asked by people, hey, you're good, would you come, you know,
would come to our team?
Thing?
Yeah,
and
I was.
Play rock and...
Well, when I first got to Antone's, you know, Antone signed me to a record contract, and then they started shopping my contract to other labels. And it was the first South by Southwest and stuff, and they started trotting me out to all these major labels because there was some big interest in me for a minute. And I did get asked by several people, hey man, you want to, what would you hire, a rock drummer, or would you consider this or that? I was like, no, I'm not doing that.
Right.
Everybody else does that.
Right. All right, so let's back up for a minute. So Cliff says, come on down tomorrow.
Yeah.
What do you do? Do you do that?
Yeah. I was...
You jumped.
Yeah, absolutely.
You jumped. You got on a plane?
I caught a ferry from Vancouver to Seattle. Actually, I was out on the islands, Vancouver Island, with my boyfriend. I was just like, yeah, see you later. Gotta go. I gotta go. Austin's calling. That's it.
With the band or solo?
Solo.
Do you... Same thing like when you went to Vancouver, you just show up, guitar in a suitcase?
I just showed up, a guitar in a suitcase.
Where do you go? I mean, that's what I want to get. Where do you go? What's the first stop?
So Clifford picked me up at the airport. Clifford Antone himself. It was like out in really late because it had been a long day coming up from down on the ferry and then flying from Seattle. I got in quite late at night. He picked me up and the whole town was quiet and we just drove around and... He said, hey, you can stay at my place, stay as long as you want. And he lived at Towers of Town Lake, which is still a great place. in a condo. And it was a big condo with its own private wing. And he's like, you just stay over there. He goes, Hubert Sumlin just stayed there, and James Cotton stays there, and what? Luther Tucker, and you're in good company, so just go ahead. And so I stayed there for about a year. I lived there
at Clifford. Kind of a guest house.
Well, it was like a part of a condo, so it was like a sort of a wing of an apartment kind of thing. But I had my own bathroom, I had my own room, I was cool.
So housing's taken care of right off the bat, like that part?
Housing was taken care of, and Clifford was so generous. I mean, he just put me on stage with everybody right away and introduced me to everybody and took me under his wing. And put me on stage with, you know, the first weekend I got to play with Albert Collins and shoot dice with Albert Collins in the back room. It was like Hollywood, you know, La La Land, really. You know,
it's wild.
Like a dream, almost.
Yeah. I mean, you really just got to step off the boat and right into it.
Right into it.
He threw you in the water.
Exactly.
Love it.
And he knew I could play. And then he found, you know, I jived really good with Derek O'Brien, a guitar player. And together we made a really nice guitar section. So we got to play with a lot of the artists that came down from Chicago. And he kind of put me in the house band, you know, as a second guitar player, backup guitar player. So I got to play with all the blues legends that came through the club at that time, which was, there was a lot of them. There was a lot of people coming through, from Jimmy Rogers to Pine Top to Hubert Sumlin to Earl King to just everybody came through the club at that time. So.
And this is with George Raines on drums?
Yeah, George Raines.
Yeah. I talked to George.
He did?
Yeah. That was in New York City after a gig at the Iridium with Jimmy.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
George is the best.
Yeah.
That's so great.
Oh, George.
Yeah.
Talk about the shuffle.
Yeah. Yeah. So I played with George a lot back then, too.
Yeah. Who else was in that house band?
Sarah Brown, John Blondell kind of did Blaze, sometimes Larry Fulcher. There was three or four different bass players. Reese Winans was in and out before he moved away. Riley Osborne also played keys. Denny Freeman was in and out. Derek, Kim Wilson was in and out. I mean, whoever was in town, you know.
So how long did it take to meet Jimmy, for example?
Jimmy Vaughn, I met him a little bit, but he wasn't really around back then. Jimmy wasn't hanging out.
He was on the road?
What happened is, I mean, I got there in 1990. By August, his brother had died, and they were just doing the Vaughn Brothers albums. That whole thing just blew up.
Right. And then he went into seclusion.
He did. He kind of went away for a while, and he was also a little just distant from everybody. He wasn't really hanging out back then. I know Jimmy now from me being back in Austin.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got you. No, I get that. I know about that time period where he just, of course.
Yeah, he just kind of quieted down and went, figured his stuff out.
Sure.
Dealt with his family, you know.
Yeah. So you got to know Denny Freeman, for example.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah? What was Denny like?
Eccentric, colorful, creative.
In what way? Tell me, what's...
Well, I didn't know Denny really well. Again, Denny...
He was hard to get to know? Was it...
No, he was a sweetheart. He was always sweet. But Denny moved to California for a while. Like, he was sort of... He left Austin for a while. So he was in and out of the city. Angela Straley had just left, so it was sort of in flux. I was closer to Derek O'Brien, like, as far as hanging out and actually playing together. But Denny was just... He's just a wild guy and super creative, obtuse, loving, but funny, interesting, you know. Out there is what I would call Danny. He was out there. And nobody plays guitar like him. You know, like, you could never emulate somebody like Danny.
Yeah. So,
and
again, you're getting to play with all these legends.
Yeah.
Pine Top.
Yeah.
Albert Collins.
Yeah.
Teaching you how to shoot dice.
Yeah. I know. What a dream come true. I still think about it. I wouldn't trade anything for those years.
Yeah.
And at the time, I knew it. I was like, yeah, there's nowhere I want to be but here. This is it.
This is
Nothing
Mecca.
Else. This was Mecca. Absolutely.
Yeah. You'd arrived.
Yeah.
So you come in with a record deal. That was the deal. I mean, what he told you.
Yeah, he did.
I'm going to sign you. And
after I got here and they saw me play and he kind of got a feel for me, he signed me. Yeah. Yeah. We got a deal straightened out and I moved here permanently. I brought my band down from Canada, so they all followed me.
So you brought the same three?
Yeah.
Okay.
They didn't all last.
Just didn't like being away from home?
Well, when our drummer went back, he wanted to go back to Canada, so we started using Texas drummers, which was great because it's such a great place for drummers, especially in our style of music and blues. It's real specific and
yes.
special here. Very special.
Yes.
So we worked with a couple of great ones. Jay Moeller joined our band, who's fantastic,
right.
and Freddie Farrow was also in the band.
Freddie Farrow, yeah.
So we had two different great blues drummers, and then it was me and John Panner. I eventually went trio. I had another guitar player, but he also left, went to another band. So
how does it work? Is Cliff saying, do you have an album? I mean, is he kind of on you about that? Like, get it together?
Get an album together?
Yeah.
We worked on that, and he worked on it with me, and he was real hands-on as far as giving us songs to try and stuff, and he was really good about that.
Was he a producer?
No, but he was executive producer mm-hmm. on almost, I think, all the Antones albums.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Clifford, which was really cool, is he had good ears. Like, he really heard the stuff. Not every guy in music or every record executive really knows that much about music.
Right.
Right? Like,
right.
You can kind of tell, like, okay. You listen to them talk, and you're like, okay, that's a good idea, sure. But with Clifford, it was 100%. He was spot on. He knew exactly what he wanted to hear. He knew how it should be sound. He knew what was good. He knew when it was soulful. So he was a pretty special guy to be mentored by because he taught me what to listen to and how to listen and all kinds of things, you know.
Was he a musician?
Yeah, he played a little bass, but he wouldn't call himself a musician. I think he just played a little for fun. But
so he was sort of just a father figure to many.
He was a father, an uncle, a mentor. He was a really good leader for just rallying everybody together and getting this scene together, this blues scene.
Yeah.
I think that having that club and making a place for everybody and making sure he brought down, you know, the whole principle with Antone was bringing down those guys, the older guys and women, to play with these young kids that wanted so much to have a piece of this, you know, and that started with Jimmy and Stevie, you know, putting Stevie up with Albert King and Jimmy together with Buddy Guy or Muddy Waters, and you know, you see all these old pictures at Antone's of all these teams up, these young white kids and these older black blues musicians, and they're jiving, and the thing that was cool about Austin is that there was a new blues sound, and that's rare, right, that a new sound. And it's not just the Texas sound. There is a Texas blues sound, but it's an Austin thing.
Yeah.
And it happened in Austin, and it only happened in Austin. So Clifford had a big hand in that.
And how old was he at that time?
He was in his 40s.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been doing it already for how long?
I mean, since 75, I think he started. In 1975, the club started. And they were doing stuff years before that, you know?
Yeah.
It's just they didn't have a venue. He finally opened a venue.
Yeah, you mentioned the road show, and I, by the way, I've never even heard of that.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
They did it a few times.
Did that happen when you got here? Was that still a thing?
Yeah, I went on several. You know, they would do these shows where they throw a rhythm section with a couple of front people. It's kind of a review. When I got here, the first thing they put me out on was something called Antone's Women. And they put out an album called Antone's Women because Antone was actually also, the record label was all run by women, which was awesome.
You said Angela Strelli was...
Angela started it and then she had moved on, but the whole staff was female, which was really cool. And they were a great bunch. And Clifford loved women and he had many strong women on the label as well as he working at the label as well as on the label. So when I went out with the Antones women, it was me, Angela, Luann, Lavelle White, Barbara Lynn, Tony Price, and Sarah Brown.
Wow.
And that with George Raines, Derek O'Brien, made the Antones Women Roadshow, which was pretty cool.
And how do you travel? Is that...
We flew and just kind of flew places. It was only a few dates, but that was really cool.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So you got to work with Luann, for example.
Yeah, that's when I made friends with Luann, because I was a huge Luann fan as well. I mean, yeah. I love it, and I love Angela. I love all those women. I mean, they were just, everybody was so talented and strong. But Luann was real special, and we became really good friends.
Are you singing at this point?
Oh, yeah.
So when you go out and do these things, you have your turn at the mic.
Yeah.
But you're also backing Luann and Angela.
I don't know if I was backing them on that tour or if I was just doing my own thing. I can't remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I might have been backing them, too. I can't remember.
Did that happen as well for you, where you were?
Yes.
People said, hey, you know, I got a gig. Come sit.
Yes. We did a tour of France with Luann, and we merged a couple of bands together, and I played on her set and stuff like that. Yeah. That was pretty common.
Did she teach you a lot? I mean, as far as... Or... No. I mean, I don't know. I'm asking.
Well, not officially teaching me, like, here's how...
Right.
You know what I mean? But you
she's
learn.
She's older, right? I mean, she's...
She's older than me.
Because I'm not sure how... If she's Jimmy's age, if she's in
She
that.
Is Jimmy's age, yeah.
Okay. So was she sort of a mentor or no?
Absolutely. I mean, I would look up to all these people and sponge off of them and learn, and especially learn about... singing, like from Luann. She's an amazing singer, so
right.
Mostly I just like to be in their presence.
Yeah.
Right? To me, that's where you kind of absorb, you know, things as a musician is more about just how the person is, their personality, because personality is the way they play and approach music. So I've always been fascinated just hanging out with people, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're here, and you're, like you said, you this is where you wanted to be. There was never a thought of, oh, maybe I'll end up back.
Yeah, like maybe I'll go to Chicago, or maybe I'll go there. No, never.
This was
zero. Not that I didn't like Chicago. I just, this was it for me.
Yeah.
This was it.
And how does it work? Paperwork-wise, I mean, do you have to get
we
a
had
visa?
To get I had to get visas. Yeah, I had work visas. That started with Mark Hummel. We had work visas.
Right.
So I had work visas. Now I finally have a green card after all these years. But.
But Clifford helped with all this.
Yeah, they would have helped.
Yeah.
To facilitate that, it's not easy for Canadians coming stateside. It's actually really difficult.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking.
Really easy for Americans to go play Canada. Really hard for Canadians to play U.S. And it's been like that the whole time.
Is it just the paperwork?
It's the paperwork.
The red tape.
It's the red tape. They make it really hard. And so it deters a lot of Canadians from coming stateside because they have to take a huge cut in pay. They have to get all this paperwork together. It costs a lot of money to do it. And now there's even more restrictions, as we all know. But
right, but we're just going sticking with back then.
Yeah, even back then it was hard. It was really hard. So it was unusual for Canadians to be down here. They didn't really make a mark down here, especially in blues, because there's so much blues. I mean,
you know, right.
Blues was invented down here. I mean, it comes from here. And I always felt like if I really wanted to learn how to play it, I needed to come down here. I couldn't just stay in Canada. Like, I had to come down here. It was right across the border. Like, you have to go down there and learn how to do it right.
Yeah.
And there's something, you can learn only so much from records and from people coming through town and watching them. You have to go down and be part of something to really learn it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you never had a job?
Not really, no. No, never really did have a job.
You never had to do that?
No. I mean, I had a couple of odd jobs. Get my first, you know, buy myself my first guitars and stuff like that.
But, I mean, here in Austin, Texas, for example?
No.
Musician?
Just a musician, but there was tons of work back then, too.
Yeah.
So, we worked a lot.
And you're just going all over Texas as well, yeah?
Yeah, all over Texas, and then we started just touring everywhere. Yeah.
So, you hit the ground running.
Pretty much.
It never let up. There was never really a moment where and things got rough and.
Oh, things were rough all the time, but.
Like what? Go ahead. Get into.
Well, just touring was rough. I mean, it was. we were young and crazy, I mean, and having fun.
Yeah.
It was really fun, but it was hard work. Mm-hmm. I mean, pulling all-night drives. We pulled all-night drives all the time. I can't believe how many. I would never do that now. I'm like, right. I can't believe I did that.
Again, good to be young.
Yeah, you're so dumb that you'll do anything. But yeah, we worked really hard.
Maybe cocaine helps. I don't know.
Yeah, I never could afford that, so I wouldn't know. We probably did a lot of weed, and we drank a lot, but... it was just, it was a lot of work, but I don't know, I just was really in love with the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, you never thought about getting out, it never crossed your mind?
No, never.
Possessed?
Kind of, yeah.
Were your folks, by the way, were they a little bit, so what do you do, come home,
they absolutely were, they probably thought I was out on drugs somewhere. They had no idea.
Joined a cult?
Probably. I mean, I just left.
And this you know, is back in the day. Yeah, you have to get...
There's no cell phones. No. There's no... I mean, I probably didn't have a phone half the time.
Do you remember writing letters? Is it that kind of...
Yeah. I wrote letters and kept in touch loosely, but I wasn't overly in touch with my parents. And then I came back with an album. When I came back home with an album, touring my first album, then they were like, okay, I guess she's serious.
This is real.
Yeah, this is probably how she's going to stay.
Yeah.
But I wasn't asking them for money or anything, and I wasn't addicted to drugs or in jail. So I think back then that was probably a good thing, you know?
So you think back fondly from during this time, or is it also...
Absolutely, yeah. Super good times. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And all the music we were able to see, like...
Just here in town,
but everywhere on the circuit.
Hit me. Go ahead. Throw some names.
I mean, just everybody. From Albert Collins to Little Milton to John Lee to BB to... I mean, everybody was out touring, so we saw everybody. Gate Mouth, I was always at his shows, and so many great guitar players. So now we go forward a bunch of years, and everybody's dead, and you're like, wow, I didn't really imagine that would happen. I mean, I guess I should have known, because they were older people then, but...
Right,
but I'm really, really, really lucky that I saw what I saw, because it really was transformative. But, you know, Bobby Bland, oh my God, just everybody.
And you were saying before, Kim Wilson was in the house. So you got to know Kim.
Yeah.
So this is the first T-Bird that you got to know?
Yeah, Fran was around. Fran Christina was around.
Oh, yeah, Fran. He's in, where is he now? Because I did talk
Marfa.
To him. Yeah.
He's in Marfa.
Yeah,
he was around. Pinky was around. Preston Hubbard. Their first bass player, Keith Ferguson, was around. So everybody else.
Did you know Keith?
Yes. Yes.
How'd you get to know Keith?
He was around. He was friends with friends, and he was just Keith. We all knew who Keith was.
Was he married to Luann at that point?
No.
They were split up?
Yeah, they were split up. Yeah.
But you knew him just from the scene?
We knew him from the scene.
Did you get to play with him?
Yep.
So what was Keith like?
He was amazing. He was, again, really creative. He was deep. He was witty. Had a real fast wit. Smart. Great musician, obviously. And then, you know, he had the whole other sort of counterculture side to him, where he was, you know, involved in a lot of other activities that were illegal and stuff that we didn't take part in, but we didn't really know much about that, as far as he was just a cool guy. Like, we always thought he was just a cool guy.
He kept that stuff private.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't doing it out in the open.
No.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, we all knew.
You knew something's up, but you don't know.
We all knew, but...
Right. He handled it.
He just dealt with it. I mean, he had
a
whole...
professional.
He was whatever. He was a
functional.
He was a junkie, basically, but
a functional junkie.
Fairly functional, I would say, but super cool guy, very unusual guy. You know, none of that really mattered to us. We were just like wanted to be close to the music, you know.
And you hung out at his house, that kind of.
A little bit, a few times, yeah.
That was my understanding, right? It was kind of a
It was kind
social...
of an open place. And, you know, Freddie Farrow, who played drums with us, lived above Keith for a while. So we would go down there and pick Freddie up for tours and always talk to Keith and hang out. So,
how old's Freddie at that point?
Freddie was in his 40s.
Okay.
So he was a lot older than us.
Yeah.
We were in our 20s and he was in his 40s.
And what was Freddie like?
Freddie was amazing. He was a one-of-a-kind drummer, one of the most special blues drummers I've ever played with. He just had a feel and could a shuffle that like nobody else. Could play Jimmy Reed like nobody else, which is a really specific style, but so special. And he was a character. He was kind of a redneck, but super sweetheart. He had a saying for everything, a southern saying, like, you know, just for everything. He was really funny.
Give us one.
I can't say, no, I couldn't even say it. It would be, you know, dirty.
Oh, we can, you can do
oh,
that.
Oh, God,
this is not a Disney channel.
I get you. I'm trying to think of one that
I know, you're trying to be ladylike.
Wouldn't be too off color, but...
That's fine. I get it. We'll come back to that. So, and by the way, speaking of shuffles, what is, for you, like, what's the shuffle? I talked about this with Mike Flanagan. I talked about this with Whipper.
Cool.
They both mentioned the cool sounds
of Albert Collins.
Of Albert Collins, which...
Rains. Also learned
George
from that album,
Rains.
I think.
Exactly. And I was going to say, just for the listeners, if you go on Spotify, there is no The Cool Sounds. I think it's Truckin'.
Truckin' with Albert Collins,
Sue
yeah.
knows. See, she knows.
I have Truckin' on vinyl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you agree with this? Is that, would that be
That's
the template?
That's a great album, yeah, for the Texas Blues Shuffle that both George and Whipper really do well. I think that's a great template.
That is it.
Whoever that is on that album, I don't even know who
it's
it is.
It's Herbert Henderson.
Yeah.
Like, who is that guy? I know.
Yeah. I I'm not a drummer. I can't explain the technique or anything.
You know it when you hear it.
You know it when you hear it. And I do know when I left Austin... You know, I was here for about 7 years during that spell. And when I moved back to Canada, I could never recreate the shuffles that we played.
You couldn't find a drummer in Canada.
No,
yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly.
And there's some great drummers up there.
And you're playing them stuff and you're saying, hey, this, and they just...
I just stopped trying because it's a total regional feel thing. And if you don't speak, it's almost like a language. You don't know the language.
Yes.
You can't really talk to
yeah.
each other. So I stopped even doing shuffles when I moved
okay.
back. I didn't even call shuffles anymore. I was like, after playing with Freddie Farrow, who is so special. Because he, you know, the thing about a shuffle is there's a lot of different kinds of shuffles. But people might have one blue shuffle. Well, there's probably a dozen or more blue shuffles. Ways to play a blues shuffle.
Yeah, what are some of the names that you, I mean, like Flat Tire?
Yeah, there's a Flat Tire, they call it that, or the Upside Down Shuffle. There's a Swing Shuffle, and there's like a Jimmy Reed Shuffle, which is more of a, there's a 12-8 Shuffle, you know, when you're going, you know, it's sort of like that, but it actually shuffles. It's hard to explain, like, but there's...
Yeah.
Freddie was really good at those Jimmy Reed ones, man. He could nail those things. There's a feel thing, you know, and it's...
Touch.
It's all touch. But it's also, I think, a willingness to do it, because a lot of guys just think it's boring, right?
Yeah. That's a whole other discussion.
That's a whole other thing.
That's their problem.
Yeah, it is.
No, but it's true. I mean, you have to love it the same way you fell in love with the blues. I mean, you have to.
Yes, you do.
You have to love it. You
yeah.
can't just say...
You can't just be bored and...
Oh, I like the blues.
Yeah.
No.
I can do this gig.
Yeah, right.
But
it sounds so easy that it's deceptively simple.
It is deceptively simple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, so again, I jump around a lot, so...
That's okay.
You won't worry about the timeline. You mentioned leaving. Why did you leave? That you said that was about 7 years. So you're 28.
Yeah.
Why?
I was pregnant. That was it. I was pregnant. I had to go. I had to go home.
But let's, again, if you can, get into that. Like, why? What was the thinking? Was it the paperwork? Was it the legality stuff?
It was a lot of things. It was health care. It was my family. I mean, I was going to have a baby. I think
now you wanted to be close to family.
Well, yeah. I think...
I get it. It's okay.
You're kind of... You know, when you're in that state, you kind of get into the mode of, like, that comfort. You know, you want all that comfort around you, so...
Yeah.
The support and everything, so...
Yeah.
It was just time for me to go back.
Right.
I didn't see...
It didn't cross your mind. I didn't mean to cut you off. It didn't cross your mind at all, like, to have your child here and then the child's instantly American, that whole...
My child is American because the father's American, but...
Okay, gotcha.
But
so
now,
that wasn't even a concern, I gotcha.
No, I just thought it was time to go home.
Okay, yeah.
I was just ready. I honestly, I was really missed the Four Seasons, too. Honestly, the whole heat thing kind of burned me out.
Yeah.
And I was missing the North. I'm a Northern girl. So there was that, too. I just kind of felt that...
It was time to go back.
That kind of yearning... Plus, we've been on the road for 7 years straight, and I was tired. You know, I was kind of burned out. Kind of felt burned out creatively, too. Like, I didn't know what else to do with myself. So, it was all... Everything kind of came to a good place, I think. And I was ready to kind of go home and nest and have a baby. So,
yeah,
that's what I did.
And so, what does that look like? Are you putting the guitar down for a while? And is it just time to be mom? I mean, what was that like?
A little bit, but I
mean, you kept playing.
I kept playing. I was gigging. My son was barely 6 weeks old. I was doing gigs, so I went right back to gigging.
Oh, okay,
and
you didn't take time off.
Not too much, no. And I kept getting offers for gigs. I just had to gig a little smarter at that point. And for the first year and 2 years, we carried him everywhere, and I took my son everywhere with me, which was a lot of work, but rewarding. And after he was 2.5, my mom kind of took over and started nannying, and I would just go away for long weekends, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does your son remember any of this? I mean, does he have memories of the road, so to speak?
He wouldn't remember the road. I did bring him when he was older, too, on a few trips, and he would remember those. I mean, he got to go to Paris. He got to go on a cruise. I mean, he went a few places. He was not that interested in my gigging situation. He just would rather be home. So we mostly left him at home.
Right.
And my mom would move in. I would move out, and it was all good. And he had a pretty steady life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And... Did you miss... What were things you missed about Canada?
I had missed since leaving?
Yeah, what were the things... Like, you know, I get it. We all... Anyone who's been away from home, it's like, oh, I'm from New York. I mean, oh, I got to get that pizza.
The pizza.
Yeah, I mean, of course. I'm saying, so what are,
in
what are
Ontario,
the things you missed?
In Ontario, oh my God, the apples are unbelievable. Seriously.
You're dreaming about apples.
I mean, I love the apples. I just love the colors of the fall. I mean, we have a lot of... It's really bright fall colors, and the apples are amazing, and my mom would make apple stuff. So I was, you know, stuff like that would really make me feel good. But I was still yearning to be part of the scene down here. I just couldn't keep my, you know... Couldn't keep all the balls in the air. You had to kind of focus on the kid. So
right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's. So we go back to that. So you go up there. You have your child, nesting time, and then you're saying the itch returns.
Yeah.
Where you're like, I got to get back. Yeah.
Yeah, and I stayed in Canada pretty much until he was 16 or 17. He went.
Oh, it's a long haul.
Yeah.
Okay.
I stayed up there the whole time. I mean, I worked in the States a little bit. I would come over and do some gigs, but I really stayed in Canada. I worked in Canada. I did really well in Canada. So I was doing some really good gigs up there. And
you were doing better financially in Canada at this point?
Well, we were steady.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you eventually, when your son's 16, that you said, okay. It's time?
Well, kind of. He went to a boarding school in Maine when he was 16 and 17, when he last 2 years of high school. And that kind of got me back stateside. And then, you know, once he started college, I started to get, I kind of got reached out to by Mike Flanagan again, and he invited me back to Austin to play Antones, and so kind of reignited that relationship, you know, with Austin and the club and everything. Because they had been through a whole bunch of stuff here, you know. Clifford Antone died, club moved a bunch of times, people left, new people came, so I was kind of playing catch-up for a couple of years. But.
Did you move back?
Not right away.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, not right away.
You're just flying in.
Yeah, gotcha. I would come in for some gigs, visit. Then we did the album, The Ice Queen. Mike produced that album for me, and since then, I've been back here over 3 years, living permanently.
Right. Yeah. Where did that come from, The Ice Queen? Who gave you that?
I wrote that song, The Ice Queen. It's a slow blues song.
So you created that?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I just thought about Ice Queen, and the term Ice Queen and what it represented to me. And I thought about an ice queen and what would be the story of an ice queen. What was her story, right?
Right.
So I could kind of relate to that story. Somebody who's been through some stuff that they cover themselves with ice, so nobody can really penetrate them anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But ice melts, of course, so they're pretty vulnerable people,
yeah.
Really. So I wrote that song, and then Mike thought that would be the good title for the album. Plus, I'm from Canada. Mm-hmm. Plus, I love Albert Collins. He was the Iceman. He's the master of the Telecaster, and I play a Fender Telecaster. I'm a dedicated Fender Telecaster player. So I thought, well, all these three things work for me. So
yeah, so you were mentioning earlier when you went to Vancouver.
Yeah.
A different guitar. When did the Tele come into play?
My pinky? The new one?
Well, I don't know where was the original Tele for you, a pink Tele?
Tele was a blonde Tele.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was my first solid body electric guitar. And at the time, I had been playing country blues. I started on acoustic. I went to a semi-hollow body. I went to a big box for a while and did country blues. Then I went to a hollow body. And then finally, I was ready for a solid body electric. And it was Strat Tele, Strat Tele, Strat Tele. And I was like, everybody's playing a Strat. Everybody's playing Stevie Ray right now. Like, every guitar player was playing like Stevie Ray. I was like, no Strat for me. And I had just seen Albert Collins. I was like, I'm going with the Tele.
Right.
Because of Albert Collins and Muddy Waters. Right. So I picked the Tele, and then, I don't know, a while after I had that blonde one for a while, and then I saw the Paisleys reissued in the music store in Vancouver. And I saw the Paisleys, and I was like, I have to get one of those. Yeah. There was two of them, I think, hanging there. And I was like, I told my boyfriend, and I pointed them out. I said, look. You know, like, I'd never seen anything like it before. I'd never seen a Paisley. And he saw it, and I think it was either close to my birthday or Christmas, and he brought it home to me. And I paid it off. It paid in installments, but he did the first payment and gave it as a birthday gift. Or Christmas. I can't remember. I think it was Christmas.
What, is your birthday in December?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it was either one or the other. I can't remember the exact month, but that's when I got Pinky, my guitar that I still play.
This is the original Pinky.
The original Pinky, who this new album is dedicated to. Yeah.
Right. And again, the other question I had was it also no whammy bar? Was that part of it?
No, I never even thought about whammy bars or anything.
That's what
like
I'm saying. Like,
yeah,
was that ever a thing?
Not for me. No.
Yeah.
Pedals aren't a thing. I'm a real purist.
Yeah.
I'm all about your hands and tone, and I'm a real traditional purist.
That's great.
And I'm not a Nazi about it. I'm not like, oh, you shouldn't do that because that's not okay. You know, I'm not like one of those snobs. You know, but I just like this way I approach guitar. That's the way I approach it. You have a sound, you just play with that sound. I don't need to change my sound every tune. I just play with my sound. I saw Gatemouth Brown, he just had a sound. He just played.
Yeah.
Albert Collins, same thing. They got their sound. They just play. You know, Freddie King, they just play. They don't, like, mess around with this and that, jumping on pedals and changing it up every tune. But
right.
I don't do any of that, so I just play, and that's how I got into what I was doing, you know.
And do you still have the blonde?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't know what happened to that.
It okay.
Went by the wayside.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
All right, so we have a lot of Canadian listeners, by the way.
Oh, good.
We're big in Canada.
Yay!
So we got to do some for the Canadian listeners. What's your favorite Rush album?
The only one I really know is 2112. But I have seen Rush live. They're fantastic.
Yeah.
They're fantastic.
Were there other Canadian bands that you were into? I mean, Guess Who? Bachman Turner? Anything?
I love BTO.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw, did a festival with Burton Cummings, and he was fantastic. You know, I love Joni Mitchell.
That's right, Joni.
And Neil Young. I mean, there's so many. And then, you know, those are the big... Obviously, the big names, but there's a lot of great artists up there.
Right. So, again, so you are a blues purist, and that was always your thing, but you listen to other stuff.
I listen by just, I don't actively listen to other stuff. Like, I don't put on other stuff.
Gotcha.
I'll hear other stuff.
Yeah.
In the wind, because you hear music everywhere.
But do you like it? Do you like pop? Do you like...
No, not really. I like, actually, my son turned me on to K-pop. I like that. I like J-pop and K-pop. I think because it's so foreign and they sing in a different language, it's kind of got a different aesthetic to it. But
is French a thing in Ottawa?
Yes.
Do you speak French?
Yes, I do.
So you grew up bilingual?
Yes, we grew up bilingual.
Is this in the house?
No, at school. Basically have to.
In school, how does that work? You split it, or is it...
Yeah, they'll split your... I was in French immersion, and that means, I think, over half of your courses are in French, pure French.
Oh, okay.
So we do that.
So you were saying, like, you go to tour in Paris or French?
Yeah.
And you're...
I can talk okay. I can get by.
Why, is it rusty? Is that what it is?
Totally. If you're not using a language, you're not really using a language, and it's hard to remember it.
So, interesting. But yeah, it's there. You can do
it. It's a little bit there, yeah. I mean, if I was submersed and I had to do it, it would come back.
Yeah. Do you ever go to a Montreal Expos game?
No.
Okay.
Never been a sports fan.
So no favorite hockey team?
I mean, if I had to pick, I'd have to go with the Ottawa Senators because I'm from Ottawa.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Not really.
Were you an SCTV fan?
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
Huge, huge, huge.
Well, me too. I mean,
huge.
That's...
Huge.
Yeah, well...
Yeah, I remember when they... I mean, that's... We didn't really have much TV, so SCTV was one of the shows we could watch, right?
Yeah.
I don't think we had cable, and SCTV came up in Canada, and before they even got down to the States, they were on Canadian, you know, cable access or whatever... local access shows.
What was his name? Guy...
Del Villano.
Yeah, Joe
Flaherty. No. Guy...
Yeah, Joe Flaherty doing Guy, the head of the local access. Yeah, you know, I know. Yeah. What a cast.
I know, they're amazing.
Rick Moranis. Candy.
Yes.
Levy, who's now bigger than he ever was.
Yeah, these guys are great. I'm so happy that they've stuck around.
Amazing. So you're back, you're here, you feel here again. I mean, you said you got your green card.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Let's get to Pinky's Blues.
Sure.
So like I promised,
okay.
We'd get back to. This was done, you, Mike Flanagan, and Chris Late. And
a bass player. John Penner, original bass player.
Right, John Penner. Yeah.
The four of us.
I know... Now, help me here, because Mike's record, West Texas Blues, that was sort of a... Well, let's just... Right? That was casual. Let's just get together and...
He just goes, I'm going to go record an album.
Right.
Middle of last year, and we're all like, okay.
Yeah. Didn't seem like
his
grand plan. It was just
no plan.
Let's just do it. Yeah,
no
exactly.
Plan.
was
three
yours,
days later, we were in the studio.
So is yours the same thing? I mean, what's the timeline?
Mine was done a few months after his, but we kind of, because of the way we went in and did his so spontaneously, and it was all cut live. We had great guitar sounds, great drum sounds. I mean, that room, the fire station in San Marcos, is this big cavernous room where you can really let the sounds really get big in there. So we were really happy with the sounds. It was time for me to make an album, and God knows we had the time on our hands. So we were like, all right, what else can we do? Because we kept looking for stuff to do last year. And,
yeah.
And we started this, we started that, we did this, we did that. And then it was like, okay, it's time for Sue to make an album. It was time because the Ice Queen was almost 3 years old by that time. So I've been putting songs beside for a while. But we had also just been playing a lot of songs and kind of rediscovering stuff that we already knew. And with that live stream we did, the Texas Blues Party, we were revisiting a lot of the stuff from our heroes and the stuff Clifford taught us, stuff we played way back in the day, and just kind of revisiting all that stuff. And it was kind of fresh in our minds, and there was a lot of spontaneity, but also a lot of inspiration that we were kind of digging up, like, hey, remember this one? It's like, ah, that's so good. And so a lot of this album that I did, Pinky's Blues, is cover songs, because they're we just wanted to do good songs. And it's not that I can't write good songs, it's just that they were there, these songs, and I was just like, let's do these. These are fantastic, yeah. You know, they're great.
Yeah.
Nobody's doing these songs, so, you know, let's just do these. And we did some of mine, and just kind of wung it.
So is there stuff on the cutting room floor that you...
Not a lot.
Okay.
If it's on the cutting room floor, there's a reason. Like, wasn't a great cut, mm-hmm. You know.
And again, so it was a very organic thing. You,
totally.
Same place, like you said, you had done West Texas Blues,
yeah.
Album.
Mm-hmm.
Go in, knock it out, what, 2 days? What was it?
2.5 days.
Recording live, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Recording live, so everything's in the moment. Vocals, guitars, guitar solos,
yeah, it's great.
Rhythm. Nothing is overdubbed.
See, I love that. Yeah, there's no vocal booth.
No, and you know, there was a couple of flubs on the vocals a couple of times where I felt like I could have done better.
And Mike was like, no.
Well, we couldn't go fix it anyway. We tried, because the way it was all recorded, everything bleeds into every microphone. So there's drums in the vocal mic, there's vocals in the drum mic. You can't really fix that. It would have to be the entire band would have to take it again, which means
right.
A whole other day in the studio. So we were like, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
It is the way it is. But we were pretty happy with it. And since we're all seasoned live players,
yeah.
It wasn't like a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a big deal. It's what we do.
Yeah.
We go in and we play, you know, we play
yeah.
In the moment. And we get the energy up and we find the moment and that's it.
Could you even get down with the idea of doing it another way at this point?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have done it the other ways where you basically track the rhythms, mm-hmm. tracks, and then you overdo your guitar solos and you overdub your vocals and they make a little map and they cut it all together. I've seen it done like that and I've had it done like that for me.
But would you want to do that again?
Not necessarily, no. Mm-hmm. I kind of like this way for what we got out of it.
Yeah.
And the way blues records are, I think, should sound, you know. Mike and I both agree that all the records we love were recorded live. It just was a given. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. They weren't
agree.
They weren't tracking. They weren't
mm-hmm.
cutting and pasting and, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I think...
It's a good way to do a blues record or a jazz record or something real. You know, I think a pop record, it's a different thing. It's a different animal.
Right. I think you did. No, it was done the correct way. It doesn't. Yeah. I was just curious if you would. You're doing a series of interviews yourself?
Yes. Well, I have done a series of interviews.
Yeah, what's going on with that?
Okay, so when my son was a baby, I mean, he was about three, in 2001. I was just, I had a lot of time on my hand. I just off the cuff one day I thought about it. I was doing an interview with somebody. They were interviewing me. We talked about, they had done a book, and I was like, just off the cuff, I said, hey, you know, you should do a book on women guitar players. Think about them all. And then, and I said, I started naming off names. I was like, think about it. You know, Nancy Wilson, Carole King. I mean, I just started naming names. And I realized, I started thinking about it later on. And we got off the phone. We just kind of talked off the cuff about it. But, you know, nothing serious. And then later on, I was thinking about it. And I thought about all the names. And I thought, I realized that I had been keeping track my whole career of women guitar players. Because as a guitar player, there's so many guitar players out there, there's so many guys, that when you see another woman and she's good, you kind of make a mental note, like, oh, good, you know, there's another one. There's somebody like me, or there's somebody on the same path as me. So I thought about it, and then I thought, well, maybe I'll just start interviewing other players just for fun. So I just, with my cassette recorder and my phone, it's all very low tech. I still have all my cassettes. I just started interviewing, was reaching out to people and doing interviews. And
see, I can appreciate that. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was very, I mean, it was long before podcasts or anything.
Yeah.
And had I done it digitally, they could all... Some of them are going on to a podcast because I've been transferring the cassettes to digital. And I offer a podcast to my Patreon people so they can hear these interviews. I have a Patreon, so I kind of do that. But I thought, okay, I'll just do a book with these interviews. And then so I did about 100 interviews.
Really?
Yeah, and over several years. You know, I just kind
with
of
all women guitar players.
All women guitar players. So I just kind of just started logging them, and I just kept doing them and doing them. And then I realized, okay, now you got to get this into a book. And I had no idea what I was doing, and it's taken me a long time. I'm 20 years into the project, and I'm still working on the book. Like I was writing this morning, I'm still sort of sculpting it. It turned out to be a lot more than I had bargained for. Plus, I put huge expectations on myself about it, and I didn't want to just put, and in that time, within that time frame of 20 years, well, the whole scene is completely different now. It's not, then I was like, well, is any of this even relevant? Because the scene is just transformed now. There's tons of women players. It's not really a big deal. It's not mind-blowing that you see a woman with a guitar anymore. Or, so I was like, well, what is... Anyway, so I've been battling with my own demons about this project for a long time, but I'm still working on it. I'm working with an editor right now, and she thinks we're in a good place, you know. But I guess what happened with it... So I have those interviews. I do some of them as a podcast through my Patreon, just as like a bonus for the people that sign up. It's nothing... I'm not trying to be a podcaster or anything. But I do have those interviews. They're a little rough because they were done on cassette.
Right.
And so the quality is a little...
Warbly?
Yeah, a little bit. But the content is really good. And I really learned a lot. And basically what I wanted to know was how their lives reflected on mine, basically. So it might be similar to what you do. I guess that's sort of a natural... urge, right? Like, what's it like for you?
Mm-hmm.
How did you raise your kids? Did you have kids? Why not?
Right.
What's it like on the road? How was your relationships? I mean, it was a lot of stuff like that, like things that I was really curious about. And I did get some really good interviews done, and there is going to be a book. It's probably a couple years out.
Yeah, this stuff takes time. I get it. This is...
It takes time. There was the element missing, and what I didn't want to put in there was anything about me personally.
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, well, just another book of interviews to me isn't very interesting, because you can look anywhere and see an interview on any of these people and put them all together in a book and bada-bim, bada-boom, there you go. So what's the missing element? I'm like, well, maybe the missing element is me. So I've had to write a lot of my own narrative into the story now. That's what I've been doing. And that has transformed the project and definitely given it more depth and more fullness, you know? But it's also a harder thing to do because I didn't really want to talk about myself.
Yeah, I wouldn't know anything
about
that.
You know what I mean?
I'm kidding, I don't talk about it on this podcast.
Yeah, right. But yeah. You know what I mean?
I get it. I do get it.
I didn't really want to insert myself in there.
Right.
I thought that would taint it and make it... But without me in there, it doesn't really have... It doesn't make sense, you know? So that's where I'm at with that.
You're the thread now.
It is.
Yeah, but this is also a niche.
Yes.
I mean, I don't... Unless you know of a book on women guitar player, I...
Oh, there's a magazine. There's a couple of magazines.
Okay, a magazine, but not one book.
I don't even know if there's still a book. I mean, I was astounded back then that there wasn't a book. I was like, why has there never been a book on this? There's so many great players. It seems natural, but...
Did you make some friends from this?
Yeah, I did. And I really value... I feel like the gift everybody gave me. I feel like they gave me a gift. So I've also been carrying these interviews around like some precious baby that has to leave home eventually that I'm afraid to let go of. You know how that goes, right?
Yes,
carrying it around like a precious egg that you're afraid to drop or mess up. So it's been quite a weird head game doing this because I'm not a writer of that ilk. You know, I write songs, but I don't really like, and I don't like, believe it or not, even though I seem to be talking a lot, I don't really like talking about myself all that much. Mm-hmm. But even though I'm blabbering right now.
Well, it's part of the gig.
Yeah.
You know, see, you should have been a drummer. You should have been a bass player. Then you can get away with
just... You wouldn't
just
have to get interviewed, yeah.
Well, I mean, who's going to, you know...
Exactly. Who will take the time and interview a drummer?
Only an idiot.
Only another drummer.
Only an idiot would take the time to seek out drummers. So this is cool. That's very cool that you're doing that.
Thank you.
And it's a 20-year project.
Yeah.
I respect that. I think that's great. But, yeah. You're going to have to get it out there. I get it. The precious baby. But...
Yeah, it'll get out there. I feel better about it now. Like, but I really did torture myself for a number of years with it.
Oh, yeah. I get it. What's next for you? You're going on the road?
Yep. We're going on the road starting in February. We got a pretty solid touring schedule starting in the middle of winter and then through the spring and summer. So everything's looking good, you know. It's just about that.
That takes you through the summer, you're saying?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
at
cool.
At least, yeah.
That's cool.
Into next year.
At least it's spoken for. You don't have to worry, you know.
Pretty much, yeah. Barring any more
incidents. I got you. Don't even... Exactly. Just keep...
But, you know, we learned last year that we have resilience and we can adapt. And that... That's what we do, right? If the bottom falls out, you just figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you even get back into Canada, by the way?
Oh, yeah. I can get back.
Well, you can because you're... But would you have to go through, like, a special quarantine situation?
Not right now. I hope not.
Okay. And is this part of the tour? Are you going to be in Canada?
Yes, I will be in Canada. Nice. I haven't been back in 2 years, so I'm excited.
Are you playing the big ones? Toronto, Montreal?
Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa. Yeah, not Montreal yet, but probably in the summer. Yeah, but...
Right on.
I'm back to my home.
Right on. Well, Sue Foley, thank you so much for doing this
today. Well, thanks. That was really easy.
Was it?
You made it very easy.
I hope it was painless.
It was very painless.
You'll regret it later.
No, I feel good.
Oh, real quick. You are doing the Jungle Show.
I am doing the
Antone's.
Jungle Show at Antone's.
Jimmy Vaughn, Billy Gibbons,
Mike,
Chris Layton, Mike Flanagan,
yes.
and you.
Yeah.
That's the band.
Yes.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad.
That's pretty good. I always pinch myself that I'm up there with those guys. So.
Not bad.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. You've arrived.
Still, yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue.
My pleasure.